It's the year 1976. America was going bicentennial crazy. Two guys named Steve were starting a computer company in their garage, and Rocky was just hitting theaters. But south of all that, just over the U.S.-Mexican border, American Ivan Stewart was driving in the Baja 1000 by himself. A first in the race's history. Though Stewart had driven the Ensenada 300 by himself, this would be a little different. The Baja 1000 is an arduous 1,000-mile drive through the remote and desolate Baja Peninsula. For many, it wasn't a question of when you finished, but if you'd finish at all. The route was treacherous, and so was the weather. Stewart would face flash floods and fog, scorching heat and freezing cold. Rocks and boulders and unpredictable herds of animals. If Stewart broke down or got injured, the journey might cost him his life. But it didn't. Instead, the brave driver from Oklahoma won the 1976 Baja 1000. Stewart finished the Ensenada Loop at 12 hours and 17 minutes, smashing the record for four-wheelers by 2 hours, a record that would go unbroken, by the way, for two decades. Stewart quickly became a fan favorite in the sport as he continued to solo race and win even more titles. How did a publicity stunt organized by a Hollywood stuntman grow into such a prestigious race? What has kept drawing racers back to the Baja 1000 for the last 55 years? And what makes the Baja 1000 one of the most treacherous races in the world? Today on Pass Gas, it's the story of the Baja 1000.
Wow, fun little story. Stewart actually hit me up. Ivan Stewart hit me up in 1976.
No way. Did he text you?
Yeah, he texted me. It was early or whatever. And he was like, hey, man, you want to run the Baja 1000 with me?
Yeah.
And I was like, nah. So that's why he ran it alone.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whoa, it's crazy that he signed up, you know, assuming that you would be a co-driver.
And I may have been like, yeah, let's do it. Yeah, let's do it. Let's do the Baja together, dude.
Yeah.
We'll be so close after.
Well, for years, you were like, we should do the Baja 1000 together.
Uh-huh.
And you're, maybe next year.
Yeah, and then 1 year, he was like, this is the year. You're going to do it this year. I'm signing up. And I was like, yeah, definitely.
But you were also doing darts at the same time,
yeah,
so you weren't really
darts.
Paying attention.
That's back when I was a big dart guy.
Yeah.
And yeah, he hit me up. He was like, hey, I signed us up. And I was like,
oops. Welcome back to Past Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan Sykes. Remembering to introduce the host this week. Across from me is Joe Weber. What's up, man?
Hey, what's up?
And we got James Pumphrey.
Hello, audience.
Guys, how we doing this week?
Joe and I are killing it.
Yeah,
we ate elk
it.
For dinner last night.
Cool. I feel like it's like an unknown mystical power has
that's like
embodied
an animal we don't
stomach.
See very often here in Southern
Max
California.
Protein.
Yeah.
Super lean.
Super lean. It was like ahi tuna.
Did you prepare it, Joe? Did you cook this?
No. I wish. Oh. It was medium rare. It came with bacon vinaigrette. And caper berries, which I had never had before. They were intense.
They are very intense.
Interesting. Wow.
It's like the nature's atomic warhead.
Whoa. Mm-hmm. Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Today we're talking about papas and beer. We're not talking about elk.
That is a good transition. Last night I was extremely tired. I don't know what it was. This week we've been shooting high low. We're in like week 5 of this. The first episode came out on the 16th for you viewers. Today's the 18th. We're really down the home stretch here, but I was exhausted after doing some aerodynamic mods.
I'm barely working on this car.
Yeah.
Every time we do this show, like by the end, I'm like, wow, mechanics. That's a hard job.
For real.
And some people do it for like 30 years. So if you're a mechanic or you do labor for a living and you're listening to us, man, shouts out to you. Big round of applause. Thank you for doing the hard stuff. So little soft boys like me don't have to.
Job was telling me that lifelong mechanics who are constantly torquing and using their wrist and hands a lot grow like an extra little bone in their fingers to handle all the pressure and torque.
Wow.
Sounds questionable.
Impossible.
Maybe. We'll look into that.
Sounds like he's just trying to justify his extra bone.
Maybe, yeah. I was exhausted, got home, turned on the shower, but was like, I'm too tired to stand up. Flipped it over into bath mode.
Okay.
Took a bath.
You took an accidental bath, I took an impromptu bath.
Yeah.
How was it?
It was lovely.
It was.
I haven't done that in like 25 years at least.
Did you get bubbles in it?
But you know what? Chloe had an extra bath bomb laying around.
Yeah.
Hot Wheels themed.
Oh, perfect.
That's exactly.
This is the perfect bath for you.
It was great. It's a perfect night. Had a toy car in the middle. That's it's not a Hot Wheel, but it was like a little plastic car thing. And I was like, this is lovely. I felt amazing. Dude, I
got a prize.
For my hard work. That's right. Got a prize. Dude, I got to do that. It's like when you get a massage, you're like, oh, I should do this more often. Mm-hmm. And then you don't get one for like 17 years afterward. Same thing with baths, man. I'm all in.
You're a bath guy now.
Big time bath guy.
That's
here.
That's cool. My new place has a big bathtub.
I need a big bathtub. I was like, this, listeners can't see, but I'm like this in my bathtub. It's pretty small, but my legs are like up. Water's barely covering the unmentionable.
For all our listeners, he looks like a shrimp right now.
It was great. Big shout out
to baths.
To baths.
In the bath industry. So if you're a bath company and you want to sponsor Hilo.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, hit us up, Kohler.
Hit us up at PassGas at Donut Media. What color is the water?
Well, before the bath bomb, it was like a nice gray. Because I came from Hilo. I was all dirty with crap.
I forget that baths are for actually bathing.
Yeah. And then Chloe's like, ugh. And then that's when she threw the bath bomb in there. Yeah,
like so. Linus.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I bet that Ivan Stewart enjoyed a nice bath.
I think he did.
Nice. Hotel room after the Baja 1000. Let's hear more about that
race.
Let's
do it. The Baja 1000 is one of the longest running and most prestigious off-road desert races in the entire world. But long before it was known as the Baja 1000, the event started out as a publicity stunt to try and sell motorcycles in America. Let's head back to the early 1960s. Motorcycles were selling like hotcakes, and the hottest hotcake in America was the Harley-Davidson.
Ouch! Too hot!
Right behind Harleys were British motorcycle companies like Triumph, thanks to their popular TR6 Desert Sled. Then, far behind them, was a little company called Honda, who was only exporting about 4% of the motorcycles they produced. Why was the world sleeping on Honda motorcycles? Well, at this time, being made in Japan was not seen as a selling point. Instead, to global consumers, the label is often seen as inexpensive, imitative, or disposable. They didn't have a good reputation.
Yeah, sort of what Korea is going through right now.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, they're going through I don't know if you can call it an industrial revolution, but they are making some really great stuff, but they still carry the stigma of cheap.
Thus, the motorcycling world viewed Honda motorcycles with a skeptical eye. Two sales managers at the fledgling American Honda Motor Company, Walt Fulton and Jack McCormick, were left wondering how to get America excited about its new CL72 Scramblers. If you want to know more about Honda, we did a whole episode on Soichiro Honda and the creation of the company. Definitely check that out.
Yeah.
Soichiro Honda is one of the coolest guys in history.
He made whiskey. He quit. He quit to go
went
make
to the
whiskey.
Mountains and made whiskey. That and more in our Honda episode.
Enter motorcycle racer and Hollywood stuntman Bud Ekins. You may not know him by name, but if you've ever seen a Steve McQueen movie where an outrageously dangerous stunt was performed on a motorcycle, then you've probably seen Bud in action. Like at the end of The Great Escape, where Steve McQueen tries to make the titular Great Escape by jumping his motorcycle over a barbed wire fence, that was Bud Ekins.
That I've heard about this jump before as like the pinnacle of motorcycle stunts in movies, and I watched it, it's like, all right. It's like a 6-foot high fence.
Yeah, I mean, but nowadays we're jaded because guys literally do front flips on
People do triple backflips on motorbikes. Yeah,
motorcycles were so much heavier and their suspension was so much shittier.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people's bones were so much more brittle.
Yeah, they didn't drink a lot of milk.
No, they drank too much milk.
But that's all they drank.
So when Fulton and McCormick approached Bud for help, he shared an outlandish idea to band together to form an off-road motorcycle race 1,000 miles down the length of the Baja Peninsula in Mexico, from Tijuana all the way to La Paz. Bud thought this would be a good way to demonstrate just how reliable Honda's new CL72 scramblers were. So, using Fulton's Cessna, the Honda team flew over the Baja Peninsula to plan their route.
My girlfriend
has a Cessna.
She flew a Cessna in Baja.
Whoa. Though the area was made mostly of remote, desolate desert, Bud Ekins was a stunt driver, and nothing could stop him once he put his mind to something. Except for one little thing. Sponsorship entanglements. You see, Bud ran a Triumph dealership, and Triumph saw Bud's participation in a Honda publicity stunt as a little conflict of interest. So, Bud brought in two other riders to do the trek. His younger brother, Dave Ekins, and a young SoCal racer and co-owner of Honda of Hollywood named Bill Robertson Jr.
I almost bought a motorcycle from Honda of Hollywood.
Wow. At midnight on March 22, 1962, Dave Ekins and Bill Robertson Jr. sent a time-stamped telegram from the telegraph station in Tijuana to mark the beginning of their ride. They would do the same thing when they reached La Paz to authenticate their time and location and create objective proof of how long their journey took. Now, since nobody had ever attempted something like this before, there was no record to break, just a record to make.
Ooh, no pressure.
No. And the question wasn't when they'd finish, but if they would. Right from the start, there were many elements working against them. First of all, this was years before the Mexican Federal Highway, the Carretera Federal 1, was completed, so most of their journey took place on dirt roads, burrow trails, and sand washes, a.k.a. not ideal course terrain. Second of all, they were using 30-year-old auto maps to navigate, and when fog started to roll in off the Pacific Ocean at night, the two often ended up going around in circles until they recognized their own tracks.
Oh, no.
Oops.
Another very pressing issue was fuel. A fuel tank of a CL-72 held less than 3 gallons, and after leaving Ensenada just 65 miles into their ride, there wasn't another real gas station until the outskirts of La Paz, nearly 1,000 miles away.
Whoa.
The riders compensated by strapping a 1-gallon plastic can inside a cargo bag mounted on top of the motorcycle's fuel tank.
Dang.
But that extra gallon of fuel wasn't going to last long, so they had to do a little extra planning. The Honda team used Walt Fulton's Cessna to carry the fuel and supplies the riders would need along the way, piloted by none other than Walt Fulton himself, with some assistance from Bill Robertson Sr., a.k.a. Bill Robertson Jr.'s dad. That's how those names work. The plane would land about every 80 miles at designated landing areas to keep the scramblers going.
Can you imagine, like, flying a Cessna and just looking for, like, a semi-flat spot to land?
Yeah. I can't imagine flying an airplane 80 miles. Now, this whole race was happening because Honda wanted to show off the Scrambler CL-72 in a publicity stunt. So there needed to be some publicity, right? To accomplish this, Honda sent out a second Cessna that carried members of the press. That's fun. Among them was Joe Parkhurst, reporter and founder of the newly created Cycle World.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Magazine. Magazines were like the smartphones. Parkhurst documented the momentous moment that Dave Ekins finally pulled into the La Paz telegraph station after his 952-mile journey down the peninsula. He wrote, "The average automobile usually makes the trip in 7 to 9 days, though the record is held by a Jeep piloted by a foolhardy soul who made it in just under 4 days. The intrepid Honda riders cut the time to a mere 39 hours and 56 minutes, including some short periods of rest, 9 stops for fuel, and approximately 6 hours of being completely lost."
40 hours is way shorter than I thought the first run was going to be.
Yeah.
Dude, can you imagine being on an old motorcycle?
Yeah.
In the sand for 40 hours?
Like, no, that's wild.
Like, dude, I bet they needed a bath.
Yeah. I bet they did.
I bet their quads were rocking, dude.
I bet they made some gray water,
man.
For sure.
Oh, for sure.
Like, you don't know where you're going. I mean, you have a decent idea of where you're going and what you want to do. There's like a plane flying around with all your fuel on it. That's like a cool adventure, man.
In the, what, the 70s? This is
62.
Like, did they have, they had walkie-talkies back then?
Maybe, but maybe not.
Because communication itself would just be so hard.
Yeah.
They had walkie-talkies back then.
Big ones.
Yeah, like CV radios.
Yeah, they used to have a guy carry it before, and then you crank it.
Yeah. Crank it. Okay.
Man, imagine being excited for war, and then they're like, you got radio duty, and you got to run behind people.
Yeah, you can't kill any people.
Yeah.
You kill them with your words.
You're also going to be shot at while you're cranking up your phone.
Yeah, but you get to talk to the Sarge a lot.
Hey, man. What's up?
Yeah, you're always next to the Sarge. That's sick. Not everyone gets to talk to the Sarge.
That's true.
That's true.
Will you guys start calling me Sarge?
No.
So lame.
We'll be right back with more of this story, but first, a word from our sponsors.
The publicity stunt was a huge success. Between the years 1962 and 1968, Honda sold 89,000 CL72 and 77 Scramblers in America, cementing Honda as a trusted name in motorcycles. And furthermore, a world record had been set for the Baja ride for the very first time, inspiring several record-breaking attempts to be made over the years. And the attempts eventually got so popular that it wasn't just a motorcycle thing anymore. Bruce Myers was a California kid who loved what many Californian kids loved.
Christmas.
Beaches and automobiles. In 1964, he combined his hot rod and fiberglass boat building experiences into one vehicle, Old Red, the world's first dune buggy. Bruce saw what the record-setting run had done for Honda in America, and Bruce was confident Old Red could break their record. Which he did.
Nice.
Departing from Tijuana at 10 p.m. on April 19th, 1967, Bruce and his old buddy Ted Mangles arrived in La Paz 34 hours and 45 minutes later, breaking the previous record by more than 5 hours, 300 minutes.
It would be great to be the second person to run this because, you know, the first person was just like, okay, don't break down. And then second time you're like, okay, can be done.
Yeah.
I'm going to smash this record.
Yeah. Journalists from Road and Track magazine came along to verify the record-breaking run. This not only launched the Myers-Manx beach buggy, but the publicity it generated helped inspire the first official Mexican 1000 later that year.
The first official race down the Baja Peninsula would be organized by a man named Ed Perlman. Ed was a lot of things, all right? He was a Marine, a florist, and most importantly to our story, Ed was an off-road racer. Back when he was stationed in Guam during World War II, he would organize Jeep races to help keep morale up for his fellow troops.
My grandpa was stationed in Guam.
Sam Brown was born in Guam.
Whoa.
Sam Brown, for the whitest kids you know, born in Guam.
Put that in your hat.
Add that to your fact bag. When he returned home, Ed continued racing, and in 1966, he challenged a few of his friends to race from Tijuana to La Paz, driving two Toyota Land Cruisers and a Myers Manx buggy. The teams were Ed and Dick Kepik, Claude Dozier.
Oh, I like that name.
Yeah. Dozier. Dude, if your last name was Dozier, that's what we would call you.
Oh, yeah. 1,000%.
We would barely know your first name.
Yeah.
Take me to church, baby.
Dude, and now? We'd call you Dozier Cat.
Dozier or Dozer.
Yeah,
if
Dozer.
If you play football, Claude Dozer.
Yeah.
Dozer.
Yeah, the Dozer.
The Dozer.
And then, like, we'd call you Doge.
Doge. Dozer.
Doge.
Doge. Dogecoin.
I'm going to change my name.
Me too. I'm changing my last name.
All of us are last name Dozier.
I'm changing my last name to Reptile.
Reptile?
Yeah.
Cool, man.
Mr. Reptile.
Oh, God.
Claude Dozier and Ed Orr, and then in the Myers Manx buggy, journalist John Lawler and his partner, Drino Miller.
Hell yeah, wow.
Dude. Drino's a sick
Drino. Drino is tight, dude.
Drino?
Is that short for something?
Drinolopili.
Drinolopili.
The actual run in June of 1967 was longer than any of them expected. Dozier and Orr came in first in 41 hours and 45 minutes. They waited for another 16 hours for the second place team of Ed and Kepik. And then those two teams waited another 10 hours for Lawler and Miller to bounce into town in their dune buggy.
Dang.
Though they all failed to break a record, Ed was inspired. He decided that there should be a more organized form of off-road racing in Baja.
I knew there was a challenge down there, Perman later stated. That was mysterious growing amongst the off-roaders around Baja. I was determined to do something about organizing it into a race of some kind.
God.
Alongside friend and motor journalist Don Francisco.
That's a good name.
Yeah.
Don Francisco.
Yeah, known as Cisco to his colleagues.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Ed founded the National Off-Road Racing Association, or NORA.
Hell yeah.
Ed's other friend and fellow auto enthusiast, Pete Condos.
I feel like it's been a long time since we've had an episode with a bunch of sick
Everyone's
names
name
like
is sick. Yeah.
I love it.
Pete My name sucks.
Yo, Petey Condos.
Petey Condos. Yeah.
Yo, is that Cisco over there?
It's Cisco. Oh, he's with Doge. The Doge is here. Don't let that mofo in the building. Drino's coming over.
Oh, Drino shit. And Banks.
Drino's coming?
Yeah, he's bringing them in.
I can't wait.
Dude, I don't like to get Drino and Cisco and Doge together.
We're all meeting up at Papa's a beer later.
James Pumphrey? Yeah, right. That name sucks. That guy's a dork.
I like your name.
James Reptile. James Batshit Reptile. Now that's a name that commands respect. All right. Anyway, Petey Condos was the person who came up with the name for the organization as well as half the funds, which is probably why they let him name it. The use of the phrase off-roading is particularly important to emphasize here because it was the first time the phrase was used for what had previously been called four-wheeling.
Oh.
By using the word off-roading, NORA opened up the organization to dirt bikes, buggies, and cars.
Very smart.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I also like when you take a word and make it a verb.
Yeah.
Like adulting.
A noun and make it a verb. Adulting. I'm adulting.
Yeah. I'm
Except
adulting.
For that one.
I love that. I love when people say that.
Oh my God. I just paid my bills. I'm adulting,
I'm
bitch.
Adulting. Yeah. Oh, I'm a cat mom.
Amazeballs.
That's epic.
I'm Gryffindor Slytherin Rising.
My spirit animal is.
My
What's your Patronus, dude?
My Patronus is a thick ass pit bull. With its larynx removed, so you can't hear it bark behind the door.
What?
Yeah, so if you kick in my door,
oh,
he barks like this. Also, I didn't do it. It's a magical creature. It happened in...
It comes out of your wand.
It comes out of my wand.
Dude, your magical creature is attacking that baby.
He's a big sweetie. He's a big sweetie. If she crossed me, he'll get you. And a crocodile.
Yeah, I feel like if your last name is Reptile, you should.
James Batshit Reptile. The newly formed NORA was officially the record keeper for Baja. Records were established by the organization for various categories, and rules were set for future records. The first official race to be sanctioned by NORA was called the NORA Mexican 1000 Rally, which was mapped out by Don Francisco himself.
The Cisco Kid!
Francisco! Nice map, Cisco!
Don Francisco.
He did it in his personal aircraft.
Hell yeah. Of course he has a personal aircraft. Yeah.
With the course set, the first Mexican 1000 was ready to begin. On October 31st, Halloween, All Hallows Eve, 1967, 68 vehicles from four different vehicle classes, stock cars, dune buggies, four-wheel drive vehicles, and, of course, motorcycles.
They did stock cars?
Not like oval track cars, but like
a stock car.
But like a stock car.
Yeah, I know. That's still crazy to me.
Yeah.
Well, people run like Volkswagen Beetles now.
Yeah. I think
you should check it out.
There.
I talk about it in Forza Baja Five Bugs. Horizons. Yeah.
I saw a lot of them when I was down there checking out
but
the
blowhole.
These
were even before Baja Bugs. They ran stock Volkswagen Beetles.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. You should play Forza Horizons 5. I talk about it.
Oh, nice.
In the donut game.
The DLC?
Yeah, the Donut Media DLC pack.
It's free. Free update.
Yeah. So these 68 vehicles raced out of Tijuana and down the Baja Peninsula, 849 miles all the way to La Paz. After 27 hours and 38 minutes, Vic Wilson and Ted Mangles crossed the finish line in their Myers Manx buggy, setting a new world record and winning the first ever Mexican 1000.
Hell yeah.
I mean, it's like records don't really make sense if it changes every year, right?
Well, I mean, eventually it's going to probably plateaus eventually.
Well, no,
right?
He's saying this was like 100 miles less than the previous one.
Yeah.
The previous one's
like
9.
Yeah,
that
doesn't matter. Yeah. It's all about the fact that they did it.
And they set the record for having most fun.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
They were riffing.
The Mexican 1000 returned to the Baja Peninsula annually for the next couple of years, with competitors racing from Ensenada to La Paz, except for the race in 1972 when they raced from Mexicali to La Paz. And as time went on, the popularity of the race grew. The 1968 event was televised nationally on ABC's Wide World of Sports, which brought recognition of the race to a wider audience. The coverage ended up attracting a wider range of professional, amateur, and even celebrity drivers. I mean, Wide World of Sports was responsible for legitimizing so many forms of motorsport.
I feel like it would have been my favorite show if I was alive during that time.
Oh, for sure. Like, Daytona 500 was televised on that. That's
Evel
how NASCAR...
Knievel, like most of his stunts?
Yep.
1969.
Motocross racing, short course trucks, I think. I think they had that.
Golf?
Yeah. Nobody knew
the Volkswagen Beetle. Oh.
Yeah. I'm just saying, like, I think, like, short course trucks, they did that at the LA Coliseum. That's why it was a short course truck. And I think they had that on Wide World of Sports. Drag racing, Wide World of Sports, like, so many forms of motorsport owe it to ABC.
Yeah. So thank ABC. Write them a letter, say, listen, thank you.
Wide World of Sports also had the dude do the dive from 172 feet. Have you ever seen that video?
Oh, shoot.
It's insane.
That sounds insane.
And he does like three flips.
I couldn't do that. I'm not built for that.
No.
I'm too big.
Yeah, you're built for pain.
I started shaking. I started shaking when I was climbing down from the roof the other day. I was like, oh.
It's a treacherous ladder.
It's scary.
Okay. anyway.
Nolan just saved you.
Hollywood tough guy and friend of Bud Ekins, Steve McQueen, attempted to race in 1969 with a custom off-road vehicle called the Baja Boot, designed by legendary vehicle designer Vic Hickey.
Vic Hickey.
What impressed Hickey most about McQueen was not his driving, but his stoic, handsome demeanor.
Yeah, and his beautiful, beautiful eyes.
And his willingness to learn from his mistakes.
He had eyes like a Job.
Sadly, he did. Sadly, the Baja Boot only made it 237 miles, where it was knocked out with a broken transmission.
This thing looks really cool, though.
Indy 500 winner Parnelli Jones also found himself called to the Baja Peninsula. After Jones turned down an invitation from fellow racer Bill Stropp to run in the Mexican 1000, Stropp allegedly told friends that, quote, Jones wasn't man enough for off-road racing.
Oh, wow.
Taking the bait, Jones entered the Mexican 1000 in 1968, where he pushed his vehicle at a top speed until it broke at the 150-mile marker. In 1970, Jones had a special car made that looked like a Bronco, but was made up of specialized racing parts that can handle the rigors and stress he planned on putting it through. He named the vehicle Big Ollie.
I've seen this car
before. In reference to his Olympia beer sponsorship.
It's in the Peterson Automotive Museum.
That's right.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah.
With his co-driver Stropp, Jones won the Mexican 1000 race with a new record time of 14 hours and 59 minutes.
It's got a big old funny wing on top.
It does.
Yeah.
They then returned the following year in 1972 and won again with a less impressive but still impressive time of 16 hours and 42 minutes. I think I've said this on the show before, but I used to crew on a Nostalgia Funny Car team, and the crew chief, Smokey, built half of this Big Ollie car.
Wow. That's a good little chunk of history right there.
Yeah, and he when they went down in 1970 to the race, or 71, sorry, Smokey said the most scared time, the time he's been the most scared in his life, was when he went on a test drive with Parnelli Jones.
Oh, God.
The event. They were going along this cliff along the coast.
Yeah.
And Parnelli Jones did not use the brake at all. Oh, and it was God. Just flying down this at like 80 miles an hour, going around turns.
In a truck.
That's like riding in Mammoth 1000 with Max Maddox.
And going through East LA, baby.
I just want to take a second to appreciate the livery on this. It's sponsored by Olympia Beer.
Olympia and Olympia's beer.
Slogan is, it's the water. I think that's so tight.
That's so cool. That's so
it's the water like where they make it with.
Yeah.
First I was like, it's so cool that a beer company is just like, yeah, it's like, you don't have to drink water. Just drink this.
It's
the water now. Our beer is the water
that's
now.
Tight. The Mexican 1000 was so popular that Nora created a new race in 1969, the Baja 500, a 500-mile loop race that started and ended in Ensenada. The inaugural race was won by Baja pioneer Bud Ekins, but surprisingly not on a motorcycle. He won in a four-wheel Baja boot. All in all, things were looking good for Ed Perlman and his Nora organization until the oil crisis of 1973.
Not again!
We hate that thing. Beginning in October 1973, members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, launched an oil embargo, raising the price of crude oil nearly 70% overnight. We've talked about this a lot. We made a t-shirt based on it. You can get it at donutmedia.com. Out of fear that competitors wouldn't show up for the race, Nora decided to cancel the 1974 Baja and move it to Arizona instead. Baja Governor Milton Castellanos didn't want to give up the popular and lucrative race, so he tried to convince Nora that fuel prices would not go up at the Pemex stations. But that didn't work. He revoked Nora's role as the sole sanctioning body for all races in the Baja Peninsula.
Whoa.
Then he tasked the newly formed Baja Sports Committee, the BSC, with organizing that year's race, renaming it the Baja 1000. However, the BSC quickly realized that putting on a race of this size was a lot harder and more expensive than they thought. That's when the Baja government sought the help of Mickey Thompson.
Oh, it's all coming together now.
Yep, dude, these guys all used to run into each other at bars and restaurants. Like when we were eating elk at that restaurant last night.
Yeah.
Like Mickey Thompson or Dan Gurney probably would have come up and been like, hey, yeah,
Cisco drops in for a drink.
Yeah.
Dozier. Don't forget Dozier.
Man. Yeah, Dozier. I thought they banned you from this place.
Yeah, Dozier came in and just took a chunk of elk off of our plate without saying anything.
Yeah.
They let anybody in here, huh?
Yeah. He pees on the floor. He goes to the bathroom. He stands next to the urinal and pees on the floor.
It's a power move.
Power move. It's cool. Doge. Now, besides being an off-road race promoter with his organization SCORE, Southern California Off-Road Enterprises, Mickey was also known for being the first American to go faster than 400 miles per hour on land when his four-engine Pontiac Streamliner named the Challenger 1 reached 406.7 miles per hour at the Bonneville Salt Flats. So, safe to say, Mickey had some street cred.
No, he had salt
or
cred.
Or should I say salt cred.
Nice, same page.
Dude, yeah. With the Baja government giving the SCORE organization exclusive rights to run races on the Baja Peninsula, it came time for Mickey to make some decisions. First, he decided to cancel the 1974 race due to the fuel crisis. Despite all the backflips they had done to keep it going for that year, the Baja government reluctantly agreed. And then Mickey recruited Sal Fish.
Hell yeah, dude.
to run SCORE International and organize the 1975 Baja 1000 race. Sal Fish had kicked off his automotive career as a mechanic in his father's garage. And according to his father, he was not a very good one.
I would imagine Sal Fish talks like Watto from Star Wars. He's like just selling junk parts to people in the desert.
Simple boy. Mystery.
God, that really hurts my throat when I do that.
All right. He wasn't a good mechanic, but he was, however, a good journalist. Sal Fish began traveling the country as publisher of Hot Rod magazine and first arrived in Baja for the 1968 race. Sal began traveling the country as publisher of Hot Rod magazine and first arrived in Baja for the 1968 race. At the time, Hot Rod was one of the most influential publications of its kind, and so coverage of the Baja race was a big deal for everyone involved. At first, Sal had just attended the race in an official capacity, but in 1969, he arrived for the Mexico 1000 with co-pilot Bob Wegeland. It's not a cool name. Sorry, Bob.
We can't win them all.
No. The Weg. No, that doesn't
work. It sucks. It's worse than my name.
Bobby Weggs?
Yeah. Dork. Robert Wegeland. Robbie Wegg. Yeah. Does nothing.
No way.
Sorry,
to spin
Wegeland.
It.
I can't got it.
You sound like a dork.
I can't got it.
I apologize to any listeners with the last name Wegeland, but.
Not me.
It's horrible.
I feel for you. My last name is silly. Pumphrey. Sounds like a balloon. I don't know. Sounds like
a balloon. A balloon operator?
Yeah. It's like my name sounds like a balloon. Pumphrey. They arrived in an MP sponsored stock Volkswagen Beetle. MP makes Volkswagen parts. They didn't finish, probably because Wegeland's name is dorky, because they had no experience and no true knowledge of the course. Though they didn't make it far, Sal Fish kept going back to the Baja Peninsula to race year after year. As president of SCORE International, Sal Fish worked to innovate and grow the organization. He got the Baja 1000 covered by national and international television. He organized the class rules by developing the concept of heavy metal and mini metal divisions. Very cute. And he created the trophy truck class in 1994 for production vehicles with over 800 horsepower.
Thank you, Sal.
Thank you, Sal Fish.
Thanks, Sal Fish.
Thanks, Sal Fish. He even helped make the race safer by pioneering a system of emergency medical response, which is a good idea. Basically, Sal Fish worked his little fins off to make the score to make the SCORE Baja 1000 the premier desert race it is today. In 2006, Sal was inducted into the Off-Road Motorsports Hall of Fame, the sanctioning group started by Mexican 1000 creator Ed Perlman back in 1967. Uh-huh. Dude, this guy ran the Baja 1000 for like 20 years,
yeah,
over 20 years, and in 2006, they were like,
yeah,
yeah, I guess you can be in the Hall of Fame. Like, if Sal Fish isn't in the Hall of Fame, who is? You know,
Mickey,
I mean?
Thompson, probably.
Mickey Thompson's in
also,
there.
This dude, Ed Perlman, started the Hall of Fame literally the year they started the race. Yeah,
the year that they made up off-roading.
Yeah, he's like, this is going to be big.
Yeah, we're going to need a Hall of Fame.
And you know what? He was right.
Yeah.
Dude, play your cards right. You guys could end up in the Donut Media Hall of Fame.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah. All right. Started in 2015.
I started in 2015. I'm in it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
You win it every year.
Yeah. I induct myself every year.
I do it at my house with a bottle of Four Roses. I'm in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, just want to thank everybody.
That's just your dog looking at you.
We'll get back to more past guests, but right now, a word from our sponsors.
Although the race became safer with Sal's innovations, the Baja 1000 is still known as the most dangerous race in North America for a few reasons, okay? To keep this course both challenging and safe, the course itself changes every year. And because of that, racers are encouraged to pre-run the route to get acclimated to the land and choose the best path. That's where the term pre-runner comes from. If a driver isn't comfortable with the terrain, it could spell disaster for even the best racer. So pre-running is like you don't take your race truck. You take like a truck that's modified.
Like a Tacoma.
Like a Tacoma, sure. Tacoma, Ford Ranger, Ford F-150, what have you.
Pre-runners are cool.
Pre-runner, take your time with it. Mark points along the course that might break your shit. Like maybe there's a silt pit that you're unfamiliar with. And
get in the pit.
You like... check it out. Maybe there's a big old rock in there that can
you
fuck
put
up
like
your
a
axles and
flag
shit.
There.
Yeah, you put something there. Mark it on your map. Don't go in that. So that's
don't
what pre-running
go in that
is.
Silt why? Pit, guys.
So why does Toyota sell a Tacoma pre-runner? That's the name.
Yeah.
But it's not four-wheel drive.
No, exactly.
Well,
pre-runner,
trophy trucks aren't four-wheel drive.
Some of them are, some of them aren't.
Oh, God, with the schematics. Who are you, Sal Fish?
Pre-runner is just a TRD. Has all the parts from a four, like the TRD 4x4, but it's just two-wheel drive. So it's, you have the suspension upgrades. You have, like, the skid plate. You have other bits, off-roading bits, but it's just two-wheel drive. That's what the pre-runner is.
Should be four-wheel. That's all I'm
saying. Well, then get the TRD 4x4.
This episode of Past Gas is sponsored by Toyota's December to Remember event.
Hey, K Jewelers.
Toyota. Hey, K Jewelers.
The Baja Peninsula is largely encompassed by the Baja California Desert, a desolate, rocky wasteland with some of the most unforgiving terrain on Earth, including the dreaded and aforementioned silt. Silt is extremely fine-grained sand with almost no real traction that can trap racers if they don't have enough momentum or blind those following behind in its wake.
It's kind of like an onomatopoeia. Like, silt makes the sound like silt.
It's very, It's the name works. You know? Not to be outdone, humans offered obstacles too. There are parts of the course where racers need to drive on public roads currently in use by the public, something a racer can never really prepare for. Besides the other drivers, a racer needs to keep their eyes peeled for animals on the road, as well as the speed limits on public roads. You don't want to get pulled over by the cops, because that can happen.
Yeah, then you got to pay them off.
One of the most unique hazards in the Baja 1000 are the man-made booby traps.
What?
Yep, these booby traps are set up by locals in their attempts to make the race even more exciting.
That's funny as hell. So sick.
They can be made of rocks, pits, holes, or ramps with the purpose to create a crash or just make a cool ramp.
Oh, my God.
That's so tight. I love that.
Racers will often try...
put a ramp in front of our house.
Racers will often try to warn other competitors about possible booby traps because in the remote areas of the Baja Peninsula, medical help is often too far away. You might be wondering how this is at all legal, but because the Baja 1000 is so long, it's pretty much impossible for officials and local authorities to control the entirety of it.
Yeah, and if you live on a ranch somewhere in the middle of it, you have no say, you know, if they're driving past for you for 2 days straight.
Yeah, like, so what do? You build a ramp.
You build a ramp.
Build that ramp, baby.
Have a little fun with it.
Set up a little photo op.
Yeah.
The danger of running the Baja 1000 cannot be overstated. As recently as 2013, off-road motorcycle champion Kurt Caselli died after hitting a small animal at high speed. 2016, only 6 years ago, saw the single deadliest year of the Baja 1000 with three deaths, including an 8-year-old spectator who was struck by a racer's vehicle when it lost control. No.
Duh, Joe, of course.
There's also an
extreme... I just want to go on record saying that's, I don't agree with that is cool.
None of us do.
Yeah. There was also an extremely bizarre case in 2007 when a chase helicopter crashed onto the course, killing those aboard. It turns out that one of those bodies removed from the wreckage was that of Francisco Merardo Leon Hinojosa, or El Abulon, the abalone.
Damn, the abalone crashed. How did I not hear about this?
El Abulon was a lieutenant for Tijuana's Arellano Felix drug cartel, and when his body was taken to Ensenada, 50 men armed with assault rifles stormed the morgue and escaped with the body.
Oh, my God.
It was never seen again. It's not really pertinent to the race at all, but, like, that's crazy.
Dude, I bet he comes back with a Terminator body.
Abulon.
Abulon.
Dangers aside, the Baja 1000 has attracted competitors from all walks of life in all types of vehicles. With over 25 categories of cars, trucks, and buggies, as well as 13 classes of motorcycles and ATVs, you can race in vehicles ranging from $500,000 trophy trucks that are too powerful to be street legal to unmodified pre-1982 Volkswagen Beetles. Since there is no qualification required to enter the race, all you really need is a valid driver's license and the $3,000 entry fee.
That's it?
It's only $3,000.
Yeah, and you know, like a support team. And
I mean, it's a lot more expensive.
However, if you happen to be under 18 years of age, you do need your parents or guardian to sign a waiver.
Okay.
Okay, it's just like getting your ears pierced.
Yeah.
Celebrities are one unqualified group of participants who love to run the Baja 1000. The race has been run by celebrities like Chuck Norris.
Okay, yeah.
James Gardner.
Sure.
Pat McDreamy Dempsey.
Ooh, he is dreamy.
And even Michael Nesmith of the Monkees. Yes, even Michael Nesmith from the Monkees. The coolest man ever, Paul Newman, the dressing guy, competed twice, once in 1969 and then again in 2004 when he was 79 years old.
Damn. God. Him
the oldest competitor to ever compete in the Baja 1000.
Rocks, dude.
Rocks, dude.
Grandpa Paul, man.
Dude, I...
He had the Oreo wheels on his buggy?
Yeah, it was all made of salad dressing. He ran salad dressing instead of oil.
Broke down.
Another noteworthy Baja legend is racer Rod Hall, the only person to compete in 50 consecutive Baja 1000s from 1967 to 2017. He ended his career with 25 class wins and is the only racer to win the Baja 1000 overall in a four-wheel drive vehicle. What?
Whoa.
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 Now I've seen everything.
The Baja 1000 is truly an endurance race, and nobody endured it better or more than Rod Hall.
Hell yeah, Rod.
And that's why he belongs in the Rod Hall of Fame.
That's a different Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Although the racetrack changes every year, the current fastest time is held by Jim Smith in his Ford Trophy truck. He broke the record in 1994, the first year the Trophy truck class competed in the Baja 1000. Smith completed the 633-mile Mexicali loop in 10 hours and 28 minutes.
Jeez.
Yeah, but this one is like over 300 miles shorter than the first one.
Mm.
A full third shorter.
Fair.
That's still a good time.
Yeah. Over the entire history of the Baja 1000, four-wheeled vehicles have finished fastest overall 16 times, but two-wheeled vehicles have done it a whopping 38 times.
Oh, wow.
By the way, since 1997, Honda has won 24 out of the last 25 races in the two-wheel race.
Wow.
And 16 overall.
In what, a Ridgeline?
No. The motorcycles.
Oh, yeah.
The two-wheeled Ridgeline.
But why are people still drawn to the Baja 1000 after all these years? It isn't really about the prize money. The overall winner takes home $40,000 in a race where some of the vehicles themselves cost upwards of $500,000. No, the Baja 1000 is about history, tradition, and securing one's place amongst the legends that came before them. In many ways, the Baja 1000 has changed a lot over the years, but it has also stayed true to its origins. It's the ultimate off-road, high-speed endurance race that is equal parts beautiful and dangerous. But it goes deeper than that. From Rod Hall to Ivan Stewart, Ed Perlman to Sal Fish, the Ekins brothers to Bill Robertson Jr., what started as an advertisement for Honda motorcycles changed the world of off-road racing as we know it. And I want to do the Baja 500 sometime.
Yeah, it'd be so sick. I don't need to go 1,000 miles, but
no,
I'd love to do 500.
A little tasty taste.
And I think it's so cool that Honda had their hands in so many fun things in like the 60s and 70s.
That's what you got to do when you're a little fledgling business trying to take over a new market. You got to take some risks.
It's true.
Baby, that's called business. That's the most like obvious thing I've ever said on the show. Anyway, that was a great story. We got some fan mail this week. This one is from Cody. Love the show. Been listening for a while. Love the cars, and I love history, and this show is a great combination of both. I think my favorite episode so far, aside from the most recent about the automakers in World War II, would probably be the Hot Wheels versus Matchbox episode.
That is
I like
a good
that
episode.
One, too. That's a good one.
That one's sick.
One thing that's kind of bothered me, though, is James's mention of who's on the dime, which has been said a couple of times in past episodes. Since 1946, FDR has been on the U.S. dime. Eisenhower was on a $1 coin from 1971 to 78. Parentheses, I have one in my collection.
Oh, you have a collection of money?
Yeah.
Eisenhower
also appeared as part of the presidential gold dollar series starting in 2007. His was minted in 2015. Keep up the great work. And Mo Pow, baby, Cody. Thank you, Cody.
Baby, indeed. Thank you, Cody.
For the correction.
I'm going to Google. I'm going to put the mic to my computer right now. Who is on the dime?
Dwight Eisenhower. All right. Well, thank you for your fan mail, Cody. Thank you for the correction,
Cody.
And the clarification. Keep collecting those coins, man.
Yeah.
And keep collecting that coin. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Get that money, baby.
Numismatist.
Isn't it funny that collecting money costs money when you could collect money for yourself?
What is that?
You're spending money on coins when you the real collection of money is the money
is
in your bank
friends
account.
You have.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, company. If you'd like to hit us up, podcast@donamedia.com. Hit us up.
Real shit, real spit.
Follow Joe at Joe G. Weber. Follow James at James Pumphrey.
But soon, I will be at James Bat Shit Reptile.
And follow me at Nolan J. Sykes. Big thank you to our producers this week, Christina Felsky and Gavin Kinzel.
And our
writer this week,
Jeffrey Murdoch.
Jeff Murdoch. He's coming
to
your house.
That's a good name. That's a solid name.
Jeff Murdoch's on his way to your house.
All right. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next week.